Good evening and welcome. It's KVC Arts. I'm David Fleming. Tonight we'll have music and conversation with Eddie Holman, part of an all-star lineup February 10th at the Honda Center in Anaheim. That's coming up later in the program. First, though, Richard Bermudez, playing the part of Judas at Jesus Christ Superstar at the Landis Performing Arts Center in Riverside. It's music from the original recording behind us. Now, if you've ever been involved in theater, Jesus Christ Superstar is one of those, you know, that you might just hope to audition for, right?
Well, it's interesting you mention that, because I think I am the only person in this production that didn't actually audition for this particular production.
Oh, really?
I was approached to do it because I had performed the role a couple of times already. I've been in the show. This will be my fourth time in the show, but I've done Judas twice previously. But the music director and director saw me in a production last year, and they approached me well in advance, which is very smart of them, because if you're a fortunate working actor, you tend to book up to a year in advance. And so they asked me early last year whether I'd be interested in doing it again. And for sure, it's been one of those bucket list roles for me for decades. And I was very, very satisfied with the last production that I did. It was around like March of 2017. And I didn't think I'd be tackling the material anytime soon, because it was, you know, it was a long, like 7 week run, and we were doing about six shows a week. And this show is, as much as I adore it, I respect the material so much. And the roles of Jesus and Judas require just an inordinate amount of vocal stamina. Just going through that and keeping myself healthy, it's a fine, tight walking, balancing act, I like to tell people. And the second week I did the show last time, I caught a little bit of a bug. And performing this role, when you're not 100%, is not one of the one of the high points of performing. It was quite grueling. I mean, I got through it. But like I said, I thought I'd take a long break from it. But the producers, they came up to me and they asked me if I'd consider doing it for Performance Riverside. And, you know, I was looking at my calendar and I happened to be free. And I said, you know what? Sure, why not? It's close to home. It's actually one of the few times I've been within 20 minutes, because I live in Riverside, so it's fortuitous that I live so close by. And it's a bit of a coming home for me, because I have not performed at Performance Riverside in about 12 years. It used to be one of my home theaters, but it's been a long time since I performed there. So it's a nice confluence of a bunch of different events, and so I'm happy to be back there doing this.
Certainly, yes. I was looking at your credits and trying to get a feel for where you were from. I found articles talking about San Diego's own Richard Bermudez, and then I saw some of your credits at the Richard and Karen Carpenter Performing Arts Center, and right here in Riverside. That's got to be fantastic then.
Yeah. I've done a lot of work in San Diego, and so I think they've claimed me as their own in the last few years, which is fine by me. It's a wonderful, wonderful community down there in San Diego, and I've done some L.A. stuff. In Long Beach last year, I did a production of Evita, where I was playing Che for Musical Theater West, and that was definitely one of the recent high points of my performing career, because I just adore that production. And I happen to be South American, and so playing a South American in a gorgeous Andrew Lloyd Webber production in a show that's about South Americans, it doesn't get much better than that.
Oh, yeah. At one point in your career, you would not want to be cast as a South American guy for that reason. But in this case, it's quite beautiful.
Correct.
Yeah.
Mind is clearer now. At last, all too well, I can see where we all soon will be. If you strip away the myth from the man, you will see where we all soon will be. Jesus! You started to believe the things that serve you. You really do believe this talk of God is true.
You said that you've done the role of Judas a couple of times. What were the other roles that you played in your past performances with Jesus Christ Superstar?
This would be my third time playing Judas, and the very first time I did the production was back in college, around 2000 or so. I played John the Apostle, but it's interesting because I've always had such an affinity for this role, and I think in my head I've always dreamed I would play it one day, but I mean, I'm glad I kind of waited into my 30s before tackling it, because it is such a demanding role vocally, and the show is a notorious tenor killer. In fact, one of the first times I did the role, one of the castmates walked right up to me and said, "You know what, I've done this show 5 times, and I've never done a production where Judas didn't blow out his voice." Literally, the first thing he said to me. And I just kind of stood there and said, okay, thank you very much for that. And I think he realized how awkward it was as an introduction, and then, you know, quickly apologized for saying that. But fortunately, knock on wood, I've managed to get through it 2 productions in the past without losing my voice. But seeing as how a tenor voice isn't really mature, I think, until, you know, your 30s, I think it's a good time. Plus, you know, biblically, it is, you know, age-appropriate as well to be playing it in your 30s.
That's about the right age. I never thought of that part. The singing roles of both Jesus and Judas, it goes beyond just calling one a tenor or baritone or just, you know, whatever. There's so much full voice work.
Right. No, I mean, it does venture in. It's essentially written for an alto female. We as men have to try to kind of navigate that. And it's interesting because there's always debate which role is actually harder vocally, you know, Judas and Jesus.
Yes.
And, you know, for me, the answer is it just depends. Because for me, I've certainly been approached about playing Jesus, but I've never... You know, for a lot of different reasons. I mean, I've always gravitated towards the role of Judas in this production because I feel like part of what makes the show so subversive is that it's told from Judas'
yes.
perspective, and he's made out to be such a sympathetic, tragic figure. And obviously that creates a lot of controversy because historically Judas is supposed to be, you know, in the ninth circle of hell and supposed to
yes.
not elicit any amount of sympathy.
Yes.
But, I mean, that's what, you know, it's part of the attraction because we kind of turn that narrative on its head. But from a vocal standpoint, Jesus... For better or for worse, people expect that rock scream, and you either have it or you don't. I personally don't think I do that rock scream justice, but
gotcha.
What I can do is, you know, I can sing some full-throated BCs, C-sharps up in that tessitura,
nice.
And for some people, that's harder, you know. So if you have that rock voice, you know, I think Jesus is probably easier of the two because the higher stuff you can scream in that rock tone. But like I said, it just depends on everybody's voices, you know. But I find it so interesting because the Jesus Christ Superstar purists, you know, they always want a very rock sound.
Yep.
And, you know, in recent productions, you've kind of seen some incarnations where you have much more of a Broadway sound.
Yeah.
The recent 2012 revival had some a little bit more legit voices in it. And, you know, and it's always very divisive as far as the purists. And for me personally, I try to... kind of do a balance between the two, where I mean, I certainly have the rock elements, but you know, I've been trained classically and I have that classical foundation, so I think that's what's good for keeping my voice healthy, to make sure I can sing it twice in one day. But you know, I have to stay true to what the God-given instrument that I have and you know, what I gravitate towards. And I think what ends up coming out is something of an amalgam of a rock show but with musical theater sensibility to it, so But yeah, I've studied countless recordings over the years and borrowed little things here and there, then kind of given it my own twist. And now I've kind of consolidated my Judas track and what I consider my preferred performance and choices. Because with this show, I tell people it's like a snowflake. You'll never see 2 identical Jesus Christ Superstars, and you'll certainly never hear 2 people sing Judas and Jesus the same way, because what's written on the page is so seldomly sung. It's entirely interpreted 80-90% of the time. So it's very interesting, though, as a performer to have that liberty.
The biggest, of course, would be Murray Head or Carl Anderson for the role of roles of Judas.
Right.
I really wanted to ask you about conscious actions or internals and a lot of that theater stuff. I was a theater geek before transitioning to NPR geek. so I was really curious how you could make this your own. Do you struggle with that at all?
Well, I mean, I grew up idolizing Carl Anderson in this role. For me,
sure.
You know, he is the originator. He will always be Judas to me. Even though he technically wasn't the first. I mean, Murray Head was the original on the concept album, and actually Ben Vereen was the original on Broadway before Carl Anderson took over. But for me, he set the standard, and he certainly was the most prolific of all performers of it. But at the same time, you know, only Carl Anderson can sing like Carl Anderson, and it would be foolish for me to try to exactly emulate that. However, to me, the pathos that he achieved in it, the arc in that, the desperation and that realization, you know, and his epiphany where he ultimately decides to kill himself, that to me is what I really try to respect and keep that, because to me that's one of the most critical moments of the show. But yeah, I certainly grew up listening to that. Actually, the movie soundtrack is probably what I listened to ad nauseam as a kid.
Oh, really? Okay. We are speaking with Richard Bermudez, Judas, in an upcoming production of Jesus Christ Superstar at the Landis Performing Arts Center in Riverside. That's February 9th through the 11th and February 16th through the 18th. PerformanceRiverside.org for tickets and information. This is 91.9 KVCR. Also at KVCRnews.org, I'm David Fleming with you for KVC Arts. What are your favorite songs to sing in here? Now, to set it up, as Judas, you've got one of the coolest tunes, Heaven on Their Minds, and this one really gives the mindset of the whole play, The Gospel According to Judas.
Right.
But I'm talking about other songs, I suppose, songs that aren't even yours, okay? The songs that you will belt out when you're in the car or the shower or something. Whether or not I can hit the notes, I will do Gethsemane. I have my own list, but I just want to see if you name some of the same ones. What are your favorite tunes to just belt out?
Well, it's funny because I feel very fortunate in the fact that most of my favorite tunes are what I'm singing in the show.
Sure, yeah.
So you're right. You come right out of the gate with Heaven on Their Minds, this amazing indictment, analysis, the internal monologue, and just it's got everything in it.
Oh, yes.
And that, to me, is definitely one of the high points. But just some of the interplay between Jesus and Judas, I adore. The moments in Everything's All Right, where Judas begins to question Jesus as far as using resources that we could otherwise spend on the poor, you know, and then using it to anoint your feet, and like, this is ridiculous. And his rebuke of him, and then Jesus' response. I love those moments, not just musically, but just the narrative that it has. And then, of course, the Last Supper, when everything really comes to a head between them, and he really finally makes a decision to betray him. I love those sections, and I think, you know, we're at Riverside here. We have just an awesome Jesus, a gentleman by the name of Nick Sloan, who I believe is the second time laying Jesus. You know, and one of the very first things I told him from the start is that you're my best friend, you know, in the show. And that whole antagonistic conception that people have going into it, you know, I want to communicate that, no, I love this person. I've always loved him. We just philosophically differ so much in how we hope to achieve our end goals. And therein lies the tragedy and the struggle of the show. And that's what I try to communicate in the performance, that I dearly love this person. And that's why it's so difficult to see where things are headed for the character.
Absolutely.
But I'd also be lying, though, if I didn't say that Gethsemane is an awesome song.
Oh, my God, yes. Oh.
And that definitely Jesus is high point, and I absolutely love hearing that song.
Yes. I saw credits going back to 05 or so, but what about before this? Some people don't know that they want to do theater until they've done their first play, and then sometimes you just know much earlier. What made you want to do this? And I suppose, what was your start in the world of performance at any level?
Well, it's interesting. Growing up, I was kind of a jack of all trades. I mean, I tell people I was actually probably more of a jock than anything. I played a lot of sports, and I played an instrument, and around like 7 or 8 years of age, I was going to a magnet school there in actually San Bernardino, of all places, growing up, very close to your neck of the woods, at California Elementary School, which I believe is called Salinas Elementary now. I was literally standing in a line of kids, and they were playing some scale, and they were having the kids, you know, repeat the scale, and it was like, you go, you go, you go, and then I sang it, and they said, oh, okay, you come play our lead. And so I think I was always had an innate sense of musicality, and you know, I sang in choirs since about the age of 7 and 8, and I grew up there, actually in San Bernardino at Junior University. There's a local community theater there where I cut my teeth from the ages of about 9 to 16, you know, performing there during the summers, and that's where I think I kind of cultivated that, as people say, the bug bit me for it. But I mean, growing up though, I continued to do pursuit kinds of other interests, and my degrees are actually in finance, and I work for an insurance firm, and but I never lost that love of singing. And after graduating from college, I came back to California and started dating a gal who did theater all the time, and so I figured, well, you know, I've always been able to sing, you know, I've done shows in the past, so I might as well continue doing it. And then somewhere around 2000, 2001, I started doing it professionally, and then it was like, wow, you want to pay me for this? Like, I wouldn't do this for free normally. And then it just from there, it kind of snowballed. And now I'm pretty much working pretty consistently these days and feel very blessed and fortunate. And it's just interesting because, I mean, growing up, you know, you can't play soccer or baseball, you know, your whole life, you know, essentially. But you can sing and act for quite a long time.
Yeah.
So you know, I feel kind of blessed that I've been able to do that. And where I am right now, you know, I do maintain the day job, and I do the theater strictly for the art of it. And, you know, I kind of feel like I have the best of both worlds because, you know, I'm not just hustling jobs. The projects that I take strictly for the creative enjoyment of them. And I've gotten the chance to play some really cool roles in the last few years. So, but I'm definitely a local kid from this area, though, for sure.
That's really cool. That's a very wonderful, comfortable place to be in. I mean, imagine being an actor with a steady paycheck. That is really cool.
Right.
Yeah, that's
nice. I mean, it's not always easy. I'll tell you that. I'm working full-time and doing the theater essentially full-time. I essentially have two full-time jobs, and so my hours are essentially about 100 to 110 hours a week where I'm doing either theater or my day job, and I'm very, very particular when it comes to staying healthy. So I'm very much guided by routine as far as eating, taking my supplements, getting my exercise, getting my sleep, getting my hydration, because particularly when I'm doing a show, especially like Jesus Christ Superstar, it's all about maintaining health. Mm. And, you know, I would hate nothing more than to deliver a compromised product because I don't feel 100% vocally. So I liken this to training for Jesus Christ Superstar because you really do have to build up the stamina to sing the show. And right now I'm kind of hitting about mile 20 of my marathon training. And it's really interesting to me because you have to find that vocal line where it's engaging, it's dynamic, but it's also something repeatable, that you're not just completely blowing your vocal wad, as you might say, not have anything left for the evening performance.
Did you have any specialized vocal training to be able to go full voice without damaging those vocal folds?
Well, people are probably going to hate me for saying this, but I've not really been trained most of my life, and I tell people that, and they always, you know, look at me with
disdain,
with incredulity in their eyes. But you know what it is I've always had a good ear, and I've always listened to singers that I really respect, and I've had a pretty good aptitude for kind of imitating what I like. Hmm. And, you know, I'd like to think I chose very competent, healthy singers. I mean, studying music, you know, playing instruments, and I mean, I just really know my voice. I know when I'm singing healthy. I know when I'm damaging and pushing too hard. And it's not something that, you know, you learn overnight. You learn by trial and error, and you make mistakes growing up. But now I feel like I'm in a good place where I just listen to my body, and my body will tell me if I'm pushing too hard. But like I said, a lot of it also does with the prep and the training for it, and just taking care of yourself and making sure you are rested and hydrated and doing all those things. But yeah, not too much formal training, to be honest. So.
That's going to both entertain and irritate a lot of people at the same time.
Right.
I wonder what we could do to say to people, just because this is not a literalist interpretation, how can we get folks to come out and see this and know that they're not going to be sitting through blasphemous interpretation? It's Tim Rice and Andrew Lloyd Webber, man.
Well, yeah, and just from an aesthetic standpoint, it is, in my opinion, their best work, their magnum opus, and they've never created anything quite like it ever since then. And just from an artistic standpoint, it's something that I think everybody should experience at least once in their life. But, you know, tackling that big, giant elephant gorilla in the room,
yeah,
you know, it does obviously take some liberties with the interplay and the political struggles between Judas and Jesus. And just telling people up front, the play does focus more on Jesus's human side and his own personal struggles,
yes,
which they are there. And I can see why some people take issue with the fact that they're seen more prominent. However, that said, there's something for the believers and the non-believers alike. And ultimately, just because the show wasn't written with the resurrection doesn't mean that it's not there.
Right.
And you certainly, I don't think it changes any beliefs that you may have beforehand. And if anything, anything that brings attention to the message and the story, it's a good thing. And there's something that appeals to all walks and all creeds and all religious inclinations. And, you know, if nothing else, you're going to be in for amazing entertainment. This is going to be a very large-scale production of Jesus Christ Superstar, which, to me, I've never been in a cast that's, you know, almost about 40 people, big orchestra, big cast numbers. So I'm really excited for that. But to me, the immediacy and the intimacy of that message is what I think is still there. And to me, it's still open to interpretation. And so you take out of it what you want to take out of it. And to me, they're not mutually exclusive. You know, just because it was written by agnostic guys doesn't mean that, you know, the message and the value is not still there.
Jesus Christ.
We've been speaking with Richard Bermudez, playing the part of Judas in Jesus Christ Superstar at the Landis Performing Arts Center in Riverside. That's February 9th through the 18th, Fridays through Sundays. PerformanceRiverside.org for tickets and information. I'm David Fleming. As KVC Arts continues, it's Music and Conversation with Eddie Holman, coming to the area soon. KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR, streaming at kvcrnews.org. I'm David Fleming. Up next, Eddie Holman. Part of the lineup coming to the Honda Center in Anaheim soon. We'll have more on that later in the program. Now, most folks do know Holman best for the tune In the Background Right Now, a hit from 1970. Eddie's start, though, was much earlier. You were blessed with not only ability, but a mother who wanted to nurture and develop that ability.
Yeah.
But it wasn't just singing, though, right? Didn't you go through piano and guitar for a while?
The whole gamut of entertainment. Piano, guitar, drums, dance, singing. My mother was, you know, pretty thorough in her vision, and she wanted me to be as developed as possible, you know, and have all of the opportunities. The best way that I could describe it is exposure. Mm. I was well exposed as a child. I can't begin to tell you the value of that because it really lasts a lifetime and it really helps you to develop and to achieve your own visions for yourself. You know, other people can have dreams for you, but the dream comes true for the dreamer, you know, so you have to develop. So my mother and I were on one accord, you know. She was really, really good to me.
Wow.
As my wife of 50 years would say, your mom was the best. She said, boy, did you have some kind of childhood, you know. My mother did everything for me. I used to say that if I were half as aggressive as my mother was, I'd have been rich a long time ago.
Beautiful.
She was very, very aggressive, very pretty lady, always proud when we went out together because everybody was looking at her and whistling. She was something else. Oh. And she was a mature woman when I was born. You know, my mother was about 40 years old when I was born. I wasn't born to a mother that was a kid herself and had to grow and develop and mature and so forth. My mother was already a mature businesswoman. She was a beautician. She had her own business. You know, she was pretty much solid herself. You know, when you're like that, and most of us don't have it like that, you know, we have to work hard and develop ourselves and get mature and everything, and then you can pass those things on to your own children. But by having an older parent, you were just so enlightened. You know, you saw the ways of the world and what was going on, and you got to see the things that weren't good for you, you know, that you didn't really need to be involved in. You know, we've all had good times and great times. We've all done things. Nobody's perfect. But for the most part, you know, if you have a clarity of mind of what's right and what's wrong, you know, it keeps you out of a lot of trouble.
Yes, absolutely. I count myself as lucky because I was involved in live theater and things like that from an early age. And I suppose because I was encouraged in that regard, I didn't really have a lot of time to go out and get into trouble. I was having a great time at rehearsals and performance, hoping for
that
applause. Right.
That will keep your butt out of trouble. It really will. You know, and that's the problem with a lot of young people today. they don't have anything constructive to do or to look forward to, or the parents are working hard, some of them, and they don't have the time. You know, it's not like it was years ago where one person could work and take care of the family. Now it takes two people working and being out and about, you know, trying to pay the bills and keep a roof over the head and food on the table. You know, it's different now. But if the kids did have something to occupy their mind positive that they like to do, you know, not something that someone else wants them to do.
Right.
But, you know, I've been through that. You know, like I wanted one of my sons, you know, I bought him an expensive Martin guitar.
Nice.
And got him with a great, great guitar player, a friend of mine that had played on my records. And he was just well known. He was also a martial artist.
Mm.
And I got my son situated with him first because he wanted to do martial arts. And then after he found out you couldn't be Bruce Lee in a few weeks, he didn't want to be bothered with it. So I sent him to a great music school that I had sent his brother to also, Settlement Music School here in Philadelphia. So I sent him to Settlement, had a great teacher there for him, and he had a beautiful Martin guitar. And it got to the point where my wife would have to make him sit in the kitchen and practice, you know, so she could see that he was practicing. And you can't do that because that doesn't last long. So he said, I don't want to play the guitar. So I sold the guitar back to the music store. I lost money on it, you know, but at least I got something back, you know. But he went on. He turned out to be good. He's retired now, this son.
Oh, gosh. Okay.
He's retired. He's not even 50 years old. He's retired, home paid for. He does good, and he's a grandfather.
Oh, my goodness.
I'm a great-grandfather. Sheila's a great-grandmother. So he turned out good, but, you know, I learned you have to develop kids through their visions and not your own.
Right.
You know, you can't make them be what you want them to be. You have to find out what they want to be and then work on that. And I always told my sons, I don't care what you do or how you do it, you know, because I didn't press anybody to be in the music business. I never put a gold or platinum record on the wall when my kids were growing up. Mm. Never.
Mm.
There was nothing like that. That's like saying, look what I did, and I want you to do this. You know, you can't do that. You
gotcha.
Know, records weren't mounted and professionally placed in our home until there were no kids here anymore.
Oh, wow.
They're all grown men on their own with their own homes and taking care of their own families. So that's when I could put my awards up and my wife's awards. But we're proud of all of them. You know, they've all succeeded, and that was our job, you know, to get them in the right track in life so that they can take care of themselves and their families.
Absolutely. Oh, my goodness.
I didn't raise them to take care of me or my wife.
That's right.
You know,
that's right.
My responsibility.
You were talking about doing what you want to do as opposed to being forced to do it. So I would love to hear about 10-year-old Little Eddie and Amateur Night at the Apollo. This was something that you wanted to do.
It actually started before that.
Okay.
We moved to Brooklyn, New York
when
I was 8 years old. And my mother and her sister, my Aunt Mabel, took me to the Apollo Theater for the first time. And I saw Little Richard.
Mm-hmm.
And the Fabulous Flamingos.
Oh, nice, nice.
And just recently worked with Tommy Hunt.
Tommy Hunt, yeah.
He's the original member.
Yeah.
And so Tommy's known me since I was a little boy. And I'm a grown man. I'm 70 years old. And Tommy Hunt's in his 80s. So he's come out, you say, I knew him as a child prodigy. He's seen me from a little boy, and here we are still friends and still work together today, all these many years later, 60 years later.
Oh, my goodness.
And so when I was exposed to that, I said, that's what I want to do. That's what I want to do. So I got my taste in clothes and colors and things like that from Little Richard and the Flamingos, because the Flamingos had on emerald green suit with pink flamingos on the pocket. And Little Richard had a suit that he could have been seen a mile away in. And so my mother went out and she bought me a pink. I've been wearing colors all my life from a little boy. It wasn't like you said, oh, a guy can't wear pink or pastel yellows and emerald greens and royal blues and reds and things like that. No, I've been doing that since I was a little boy.
Nice.
So my mother bought the uniforms and stuff. You know, when you help yourself, people will help you.
Sure.
And, you know, my mother always kept us well-groomed and well-dressed, you know, and the teachers would talk about it, the principal, you know, so, oh, my God, these kids look so great, my sister and I. And they said, you know, they wanted to meet our mother. You know, my mother was always going places with us and taking us places. And they told my mother, they said, you know, you do such a wonderful job with these kids. We want to help you with them. And they did. They gave us things. I mean, brand new clothes. And
wow. Oh, wow.
All because my mother took good care of us than other people. So I had a teacher say, look, there's a great school up in Harlem called Victoria School of Music and Art.
Yes.
And I think your son and your daughter would really do great there. And she knew the director, Mr. Bill Carr, and set up a meeting, and we went up to the school. They were located right down the street from the Apollo in the Victoria Lowe's building, where the Victoria Lowe's movie theater was. And they were located up like around the third floor there, a huge, huge place. And a lot of great entertainers, Frankie Lyman went there, Baby Washington, a lot of great entertainers from that era studied there. And it was just so wonderful, man. You know, you couldn't wait till Saturday came around. So through that, you know, all the kids were in different things. You know, I was one of only three black children that were regulars on the NBC Children's Hour, which was nationally shown. You know, so people saw me when I was a kid, including my wife, in Philadelphia on television.
She was in Philly, and you were in New York at this point. You were both children.
Yeah, oh,
but
no,
she remembers seeing you.
But she knew me being on television. There weren't that many black people on TV.
Okay, well, good point. Okay.
So it was really a wonderful experience. And through that, I got to perform in off-Broadway plays. Some of the children did movies. Some of them did recordings. Everybody was involved in something spectacular and special for a young person. So then when I turned 10, we literally lived at the Apollo. So I got to see and meet a lot of great, great people whom I went on to open up for people. I worked with Ruth Brown.
Oh, wow.
Donna Washington, opening up for them. Got to meet Harvey Fuqua and the Moonglows, the Dells, Jackie Wilson.
Mm.
I mean, great, great, great people. So we saw them all. We met them all. We hobnobbed with them. And for my 10th birthday, my mother got, she was a friend of Barbara Williams. She was secretary to Mr. Schiffman, the owner of the Apollo at that time. So for my 10th birthday, I was on the Amateur Hour. And the show was, it was one of Jocko Henderson's. He's one of the greatest disc jockeys that ever lived. And we wound up becoming neighbors many, many years later in Philadelphia. And Jocko Henderson used to give the rocket ship shows at the Apollo. And they used to have 10, 12 of the greatest, hottest acts at that time. And on that show, that Wednesday that I was scheduled to perform, Barbara Williams, beautiful lady. Matter of fact, I liked her so much. I said, one of these days I'm going to marry a girl like that. And I did. See, I loved the way she looked. She was fine, you know. And I was always attracted to ladies that looked like that, including my wife. When I met her, I didn't ask her to marry me. Within 45 minutes of meeting her, I was crazy about it. You know, I said, boy, then it used to be a couple of, in those days, they had shake dancers, exotic dancers. And these women would wear scanty outfits.
Okay.
And a couple of these girls were customers of my mother. You know, she did their hair. And they were, I worked on shows along with them and Speedo and the Cadillacs. And then they had what they had two girls. They looked just like my wife. Mm-hmm. They were called the Spence Twins.
Spence Twins.
Twins. They were beautiful. And they were so fine. And they looked so good. They started riot. That's how good they looked. They came out on the stage and started dancing. If the place would go crazy, they had to call the police.
Oh, wow.
To calm the people down. You know, the Spence Twins, they were fine. You know, on that show, Deftones were on that show. Frankie Lyman was headlining. And they told Frankie Lyman there was a kid that was going to be singing his song, Why Do Fools Fall in Love.
Right.
You know, they might want to stick around and check him out. And they did. Herman Santiago and Frankie Lyman and Jimmy Merchant, they stayed to see the show. And I won first prize. And Frankie Lyman presented me with the first prize. And we became friends, you know. He called me when he was doing his first tour of England. I've been touring England now 43 years now. I've been a legend in England for 50 years. And here's Frankie Lyman calling me. He was all excited that he was going to England and couldn't wait to do the show and shows that they had to do over there. So a gentleman named Mr. Walter Cato, he was a popular theatrical agent at that time, and his office was located in the same building as Victoria School of Music and Art.
Okay.
And he signed me. That's how I became a professional at the age of 10. He signed me. And I was working literally every weekend, upstate New York, all over the place, opening up for, you know, great acts. That's how it started. I had already performed several times at Carnegie Hall. I made a record. I was performing at Carnegie Hall, Town Hall, Manhattan Center, all the great places in New York.
Eddie Holman at the Honda Center in Anaheim, February 10th, along with Lenny Williams, Tavares, and quite a few others. HondaCenter.com for more on this one. More with Holman just ahead as KVC Arts continues.
I had a wonderful stepfather, Mr. Tom Robinson, from Americus, Georgia. He was crazy about my mother, and he kept coming to New York and asking my mother to marry him. And when my mother thought my sister and I were old enough to understand, she told us, you know, and we liked him, you know. He'd come and take us all out and so forth, and he was always kind to my sister and to me. And he said, Vi, if you marry me, I'll buy you a house in Philadelphia. So my mother married him, and he bought us a home in Philadelphia. My sister owns that home now. You know, that's how we got to Philly.
Okay.
From New York. Now you're in Philadelphia. Philadelphia is nowhere near as, you know, opportunities to work and so forth that you have in New York. So my mother took me back to New York to get a record deal. That's how I got involved in recording, because not living in New York, you know, a lot of the activities that we did, you know, you couldn't do as much in Philadelphia. But what happened was I did an amateur show here with the great late disc jockey Georgie Woods at the Christian Street Y in South Philadelphia. And I won first prize. I won a recording contract. And I did actually record, but those records were never released. My mother took me to New York and got me signed with Joe Rene. Joe Rene was the man who produced the Jive Fives, My True Story, and Bobby Lewis's hits, Tossing and Turning, and so on.
Oh, sweet.
And she took me up to his office. He asked my mother, said, well, what does your son do? She said, he sings. He said, well, have him sing something for me. And I sang for him. He said, sign, done. And he said, what would you like to do, son? I said, I want to make a record with violins and a choir in the background. He said, it's done.
Wow.
So So the first records I made, remember the Angels?
Mm-hmm.
Angels were not only great artists, those girls, in their own right, songs like Till and so forth, they were great background singers. They were the girls that sang on the background of all Bobby Lewis's records and all of the Joe Renee records.
Oh, wow.
So they sang in the background of my records, same band, same orchestra. And the first record I made was What You Don't Know Won't Hurt You. That was released.
It's on
and
Leopard
then the
Records.
Flip side of it's called I'm Counting Every Tear, full orchestra and choir.
Wow.
I'm a kid. and he did exactly what I asked him to do. So we recorded several other records with him. At that point, you know, I had what you call turntable hits. And I had a lot of friends that I had made from that, you know. So I got exposed with Jocko and some of the great jocks in New York and Philadelphia and Baltimore, Washington. Mm-hmm. And they all liked me. So I had been writing since I was 10 years old. My mother made sure that I could write songs to help develop me to become a writer. So I started writing when I was 10, became a BMI writer when I was 16, and an AFTRA member.
Right.
I receive a pension from AFTRA. I was an AFTRA since I was 16 years old.
Oh, my goodness.
Then I became a BMI publisher and an ASCAP publisher. My wife's an ASCAP writer and publisher. Platinum writer. I'm a platinum writer. And all that started because of my mother when I was 10.
Oh, wow.
10 years old.
Wow.
And so we developed that. So then my vision was, well, I can write songs. And the first records that I actually recorded, I had wrote. But when I started making records that became what they said were turntable hits, they got an awesome amount of play and exposure. You know, to have that kind of thing going on, you know, you make a lot of friends. You meet a lot of people. Well, the people who had did the first records, so they were running all over the place trying to sell them. They said, we got some Eddie Holman records. So they're selling my first recordings that I made.
What You Don't Know Won't Hurt You.
What You Don't Know Won't Hurt You was the first record, and I'm Counting Every Tear. So what I did from that point, by then, now I'm in high school, I started making records and popular and everything, and I said I was going to continue to write, and I said I'll write my own hit record, you know, mm-hmm. because people were depending on writers to write them songs. If you didn't have a hit record, I don't care how good you sound or how good you could sing, it didn't mean anything. So I wrote my first hit record. I took it from a song by the Four Tops. I always loved the Four Tops. You know, of course, eventually got to work with them and tour with them. So my first hit record I took from them. They had it like in an up-tempo way. They did a song called Just Ask the Lonely, and I loved it. And the songs, dun, 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 boom, 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 ba-dum, boom, boom, boom. That was how the song went with them. You know, Just Ask the Lonely. They know the hurt and pain. So what I did, I took the beginning of that, and I took down, down, doom, ding, 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 boom, boom, ding, boom, boom, boom. I turned it into a ballad, a love song, and that was my first hit record.
This Can't Be True.
When I was in college. This okay. Can't Be True. That was the one that made me a legend.
Nice. Wow.
If I never made another, ain't nobody can sing falsetto like I did. I own it. It's mine. And see, the advantage I had, I saw all the great falsetto singers. I grew up with little Anthony Gardine. He's still a friend.
Oh, wow.
I grew up with him in the Fort Greene in Brooklyn. So I was like 11. He was 19 years old. You know, Ernest Wright, one of the original members of the Imperials, his okay. brother was my best friend, Tommy,
oh, wow.
Tommy Ray. So I saw all of the great falsetto singers and tenors, and I developed my own falsetto. I said, well, I know what the best of these guys have done. I'm going to do it in a way that nobody else can do, and that's what I did.
What was it that you tried to do differently to differentiate yourself from some of the other falsetto singers at that point?
Well, for one thing, I had been brought up to properly pronounce every word that, you know, when you're singing a song, you're actually painting a picture. And if people can't understand the words and the lyrics and hearing what you're saying, you know, you can't paint the picture. They don't know where you're coming from, you know? That's what I learned. And in singing in the high voice, I noticed that some of the groups, the high tenors, their approach to the lyrics were kind of slangy. And when I say slangy, I mean they were the young people of that day. And the way they expressed themselves were the way that people expressed themselves on the streets of Brooklyn and Harlem. And that's the way they made the records. But I wasn't brought up to do that. I was brought up to speak the King's English clearly. And my mother, she raised me on Nat King Cole and Tony Bennett, Frank Sinatra, guys like that, because of their command of the language and how, you know, they could tell a story and how you could clearly hear what they were saying. So in my approach to falsetto and singing high, it was to make sure that the words were clear. And no one says the word girl like I do. When I say the word girl, girls shatter. They shake. No one says girl like I do. And some of my biggest records have the word girl in them.
Yeah. Hey there, lonely girl. Yeah.
Hey there, lonely girl. Yeah. So that was my approach, to make sure that you could be clearly heard by the listener, so there was no mistake about what he said or how he said it and what he meant. And here I am, a kid. What do you know about love as a kid?
Right.
You ain't experienced none. And I sang love songs, and they were tearing people up, man. I was singing love songs. They said, the guy sings like he's 40 years old. You know, like he's lived life and whatnot. What it was the exposure that I had from my mother and the people that she had me listen to. And the people she took me to see. One of her favorite singers that she wanted me to see was Little Jimmy Scott.
Oh, gosh, wow.
One of the greatest singers that ever lived.
Yeah.
She took me to see Jimmy Scott. She said, now you watch him and you listen to him. And I did.
Eddie Holman, again, just a part of the lineup at the Honda Center in Anaheim, February 10th. HondaCenter.com for the complete lineup. And that's just about going to wrap up another edition of KVC Arts. Thanks once again to Eddie Holman and to Richard Bermudez, Judas, in an upcoming production of Jesus Christ Superstar at the Landis Performing Arts Center in Riverside. PerformanceRiverside.org for more. Here at KVCR, thanks to Lillian Vasquez, Rick Dulock, Jessica Greenwell, and KVCR General Manager Keith Birkfeld. Music beds and themes heard on KVC Arts, Behind Us Now, for example, composed and performed by Sean Longstreet, so thanks to Sean as well. You can hear past KVC Arts programs via podcast at kvcrnews.org/arts. I'm David Fleming. Thanks especially to you for listening and for your support.